Top 100 Project
and action.
Welcome to the podcast, gang. The Top 100 Project takes a look back at the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. Fair warning right now, a heap of spoilers are in your immediate future. I'm Ryan Ellis, here with my very own queen, my wife Bev.
That's me.
All right, the coming attractions trivia for The African Queen, this week's film. John Huston is one of four directors of an AFI movie who later appeared in an AFIer as an actor only. Cameos in their own films do not count. Who are the other directors turned actors?
Buster Keaton, Orson Welles. Oh, you're going to tell me and I'm going to kick myself.
To backtrack, Huston directed three movies and acted in Chinatown. Mm-hmm. Buster Keaton actually plays himself, so maybe we're being a little bit cheesy.
And
there.
He has like one little line.
But he's too. In the movie, though. Yeah. But he's in Sunset Boulevard as an actor and directed mm-hmm. The General. Orson Welles directed and acted in everything else in Citizen Kane and, of course, had his role in Third Man. And the other guy is Dennis Hopper.
Oh, my God. That's right.
First, he was an actor in Giant and in Rebel Without a Cause. Then he was an actor and a director in Easy Rider.
Yeah.
In Apocalypse Now. And at the end of this podcast, for next week's trivia, the question will be somewhat similar to this one.
Okay. I wait with bated.
All right, the Top 100 Project's 42nd movie, The African Queen, was 17th on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list between All About Eve and Psycho, but took an enormous nosedive and ranked 65th in 2007 between Network and Raiders of the Lost Ark. That 48-spot dip was the biggest of any film between 98 and 07 that did make both lists. After a premiere just in time for Christmas and Academy Award consideration on December 23, 1951, United Artists released The African Queen for everybody on February 20th of the following year. A hit! Audiences and critics, too, love seeing Bogie and Hepburn ride the river in that cranky old boat. Bev will tell us a little bit about it with the skinny.
Gin-swilling boat captain Charlie Allnut, played by Humphrey Bogart, joins forces with missionary Rose Sayer, played by Katharine Hepburn, as they make the treacherous trip down the Ulongabora River in East Africa. World War I has broken out, and Rose is determined to sink a German warship at the mouth of the river for patriotic and vengeful reasons.
Or in a nutshell, mailman and new wife survive explosion of their own making.
I have my own nutshell that I wrote for this.
Hit me.
Expat adrenaline addict coerces amiable ship captain to go on a suicide mission.
It is that from the start. She's obsessed. All right, this is a very beloved film for a lot of people. I don't know if we can say the same.
I can't say that I behated it, but...
A new word has been invented for this podcast.
Like, I sure as hell liked it better than American in Paris or Swing Time. But I'm a little baffled to why it's held in as high esteem as it is.
17th!
I get why people like it. I don't get why people love it. I don't get why people think it's one of the greatest films of all time.
It's one of the movies when I saw the first show that I'd never heard of it. When we got to the top 25 or 30, I think I knew most of the movies. I'd seen a lot of the movies. Of course, the most famous ones.
Mm-hmm.
I recognized Bogart and Hepburn, of course, when I saw the clips, but what is that movie?
Yeah, I saw it because I had a teacher at some point show it to our class on one of those very close to summer vacation days when they just would rather drag in a TV than teach us anything. And I remember always thinking that I never appreciated it just because I was 16 or 17 the first time I saw it. But I think maybe I just don't appreciate it. I think I'm missing something. I find myself remembering it with great fondness, like more so than when I was watching it. Kind of a similar experience to what I had watching, say, Sunrise or Mutiny on the Bounty. Like, I don't enjoy the experience of watching it, but when I think about it, I'm kind of delighted by the characters.
So those films, which are quite a ways in our past now, Sunrise and Mutiny on the Bounty, they've stayed with you then?
Yeah, definitely. Sunrise more so, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But I remember when we watched it, I didn't enjoy the experience of watching it at all. But I enjoyed the experience of thinking about it afterwards, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, of course it does. There have been a lot of movies that I've seen over the years that months or even years later, I will come back to them. I think the first thing I'm thinking about right now as you talk about this, Magnolia.
Oh, really?
The recently deceased Philip Seymour Hoffman. We mentioned him on our last week's podcast for Eternal Sunshine. Say it again. What a shame that guy is gone. And that's a movie I didn't like when I first saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet somewhere in there, I saw it again, sat down for 3 more hours and went from not liking it to thinking it was excellent. My point is that a movie can stick with you in a way that you, A, wouldn't expect to, and B, can go from being a movie you didn't like to, wait a minute, I was full of crap.
In the case of this, it's more like when I remember it, I just don't remember the flaws. I don't remember the things that I didn't like. I don't remember the kind of clumsiness and, God, I know this is probably sacrilegious to say, but in some points their performances are really sloppy and mechanical and weird and kind of take you out of the story, and there's the... I'm sure great for the time, but now watching them, the special effects are just excruciating at points. And sometimes the plot, the motivations for the plot just seem to come from nowhere, and it's just kind of like frustrating and even a little bit insulting, whereas other things they go out of their way to exhaustively express to you that say, for example, Rosie doesn't like drinking, and in case you were wondering, we're just going to watch her glowering at Charlie for what felt like 3 full minutes while he's swilling back some gin without misbehaving. On his boat. And he doesn't misbehave. He's not like a mean drunk. Yeah. He's not a bad drunk at all. But there's this really extended shot of her just giving him stink eye while some terrible score plays in the background.
I wonder if that was art imitating life for two reasons. One, because she spent so many years with Spencer Tracy, who we've learned since was a hell of an alcoholic. And two, apparently Houston and Bogart were drinking so much in this movie that she rebelled by drinking only water and then got sick from dysentery, I guess is what it was.
That's right.
And that those two didn't drink or eat anything that was local. There's the same story, Spielberg, for, I think it was Raiders of the Lost Ark, only ate SpaghettiOs or something when he was there, and he's one of the only ones that didn't get sick or dysentery. But yeah, she probably had those two motivating factors. One, that was in front of her for weeks when they were shooting this movie on location. And two, living with a dude who was an alcoholic.
Well, I don't know what motivated Houston to let that shot play out for as long as it did, with the score to accompany, just in case the audience wasn't gathering that she doesn't like drinking. Yeah. Along with, there's a few other times that they did the same sort of thing.
When she's dumping his gin out in the river, even if he's not an alcoholic, even if he just likes to drink, I mean, that's not your property, lady. You're going to dump all this out. He puts up such a meek fight.
Yeah, it's pathetic. He doesn't even stand up. He's just like, oh, no, don't throw my gin, cut it out. I wish you wouldn't.
Stop dumping glass in the river, you environmental killer.
I guess that was before, you know, Silent Spring was published. I don't think people were all that aware of pollution at the time.
Yeah. A key word that I read in one of the reviews was appealing. And it's very apt, because the movie is appealing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a weenie description, and the movie isn't very deep.
Yeah, it's not a good enough reason to call it a great movie. Although, as we've mentioned many times, you know, a lot of the movies on the list are really just fun. You wouldn't say Bringing Up Baby is deep or The Gold Rush is deep. Like, these movies, even though they're considered consummate classics, they're not deep. So you can't really fault African Queen for that, but there's still something else that just feels like it could have done better.
I think you can when you consider that the people involved, particularly the men, but even Hepburn, had done deep things. Bogart and Houston with Maltese Falcon and Treasure of Sierra Madre, there's some themes in there. There are some great subtextual themes, and Bogart certainly in Casablanca has that. And Hepburn with, well, Philadelphia Story and Bringing Up Baby, her previous films, they're not the deepest.
It's not like it's a shallow subject. You're talking about missionaries in Africa, World War One. Like, these are things that you could draw some really great, deep material about. Imperialism and the expansion of Christianity into Africa, the expat community in Africa, these are things that you could really draw so much subject matter from, and they don't. It's kind of wasted.
That missionary thing, by the way, I've never had much respect for missionaries, at least when I started realizing the way I felt about religion. Let's put it that way, to put it nicely. I think they mean well, but they're going into a place that doesn't need or want what they're selling.
I know. Oh, I don't think that this movie really pays that much respect to missionaries either.
No, that's what she is. That's what her brother is.
Yeah.
And by the way, this movie's a two-hander. One of the only movies on the list that has such a small cast. I think there's 11 people. They're credited in any way, the entire cast. There will be movies that we'll do that will have a smaller cast. 12 Angry Men and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf will have smaller casts, but this is certainly one of the smallest ones. And yet it's got, so far, one of the biggest scopes, because it's one of the few location movies. Here they are, truly in Africa. Yes. They shot a lot of the movie in London, too, I was reading. Yeah. And I'm sure some of it was shot in Hollywood.
But taking this to Africa was incredibly ambitious, especially because it was Technicolor.
Yes.
It's a huge camera that they had to take, very cumbersome, and everything about that made it a very difficult shoot. And it was on the water, too.
Yeah.
They had to build an elaborate raft that had parts of the African Queen on it that they could take
out. Like the way they break up a car for shoots in modern car scene. You mentioned color. I want to say this. This is two FIs in a row now that we've had that are color. We've got a few black and white films in March, but we'll see more color than black and white from now on through the rest of the project, which makes sense. As we get more modern, there will be black and white films here and there. but generally they'll be Technicolor, and this certainly plays into that. And incidentally, since we're going to talk about the look of it, cinematographer Jack Cardiff, mm-hmm. very famous name in that business, he shot movies for two directors. I think we may have mentioned them very recently. In American in Paris, we mentioned them.
Oh, okay.
Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, because they made The Red Shoes. And Gene Kelly was inspired by The Red Shoes when he made American in Paris. Cardiff was known to make movies with them, and yet, ironically, later in his career, he worked on Rambo and Conan sequels. He even directed at some point in the 50s and 60s a few times. This Cardiff fellow really got around. He was an English cinematographer who really covered the basis of working with classic people and working with John Huston. Not that he wasn't classic, but working with the English guys, John Huston, and then Rambo and Conan. And that also plays into the special effects. You didn't like the special effects, and I agree that they don't look very good now, but then 1985 special effects don't look very good now, really.
I know,
1995 don't probably look very good.
It's true. It's not really a fair criticism.
But considering they shot it on location, and they had to use so many mats and miniatures, I mean, the boat scenes when they go down the rapids, apart from some inserts, they're not ever in those boats. Of course, they've been too dangerous. And incidentally, I think Deliverance did the whole rapids thing a little more realistically.
Yeah.
Because somehow they survive these rapid scenes, and she's the one steering the boat. I don't think that she'd be a good enough boat captain when she's never done before
when
to get
them
through
over,
that.
When they go over, that second set of rapids, I don't know how it doesn't get overturned. And here's what actually one of my main problems with the movie. They just repeatedly ask us to suspend our disbelief in such an extreme way.
Even the scene when the Germans are shooting at them and somehow don't
Come
hit them.
On.
He's taping up the... And it's a good suspense scene, but he's taping up the hose on the boiler.
All the German soldiers are stormtroopers. They have the worst aim possible.
It is a moving target, and they are a little far away, but they're still stormtroopers. You're correct.
Yeah.
But our heroes can never be hit. She would probably not be hit from that angle because she's ducked down far enough low, but he makes himself very available. He's trying to tape up the bad boiler.
But it's hard to feel like they're in peril at all when they're presented with all these challenges and Charlie says every single time, this is suicide, we'll die, and then they don't die. Guess what? They don't die. And it just keeps happening over and over again, and each time there's like this increasing odds against them right up to the end, which by then I'm just rolling my eyes.
They don't really seem all that scared through a lot of it either.
Yeah,
maybe he's seen it all. But she hasn't.
Yeah, and her motivation is a little underdeveloped, let me put it that way.
Her brother is played by Robert Morley. He's brother Samuel Sayer. He's, I guess, essentially in charge of the missionaries, and she's working with him, but it's kind of his mission.
Mm-hmm.
He'd later be in Around the World in 80 Days and Top Copy, but was never in any other AFI movies. He's got the third most screen time of anybody in this movie.
Which is not much.
I think the wildlife has more screen time than the supporting cast in this film. Yeah. There's other guys, the Theodore, I think it's pronounced Beekel or Beekel. He's the first officer on the German boat at the end. And he was also in the Defiant Ones as the sheriff and then worked with John Huston the next year on Moulin Rouge, not the movie we know from modern times, but the original.
No, the 50s version, yeah.
And he was in AFI or My Fair Lady. And the only other cast member that I even made a note about was the German captain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Peter Bull, who we will soon see, maybe not soon, but eventually see in Dr. Strangelove. He's the Russian ambassador.
Oh my god! Yeah. I didn't recognize him at all.
I didn't recognize him, but I looked it up.
Oh, that's so cool.
That's the cast.
Yeah.
We'll talk a little bit more about the stars in a minute, but we won't talk about the supporting cast anymore.
Let's talk a little bit about the wildlife, because that's something that probably was relatively unseen in the 50s. Color photography of the wildlife of Africa. And there's tons of really great footage of it, and it's kind of a charming aspect of the film. Africa's represented really well. It's really beautifully shot. So kudos to them for going out on a limb and going all the way to Africa with all this gear to get this, at the time, probably would have been one-of-a-kind footage.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely for a major Hollywood movie with these two stars.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had dangers, for sure. Definitely they had dangers when they were shooting in Africa, but they didn't have the kind of dangers that looked like they did. In a good movie, of course.
No, of course
makes it look
not.
Worse than it really is.
Yeah.
But when they go in the water, that's some tank.
Thank God for them, because it actually does look absolutely excruciating.
Speaking of
terrible.
London, and speaking of making it look authentic where they were shooting, Robert Morley never once appeared in Africa. They shot all his scenes back in London.
Really?
And they made it look like he's preaching in front of this.
Oh, wow, because that stuff is really very convincing.
Yeah. So the movie was set in German East Africa, September 1914. So we're only a few months shy of it being 100 years ago when
this
was
that's
set.
Right.
We mentioned they shot in England. Plenty of the movie was there. They shot some in America. If we didn't say this already, they also shot in Congo and Uganda. Now, I have a trivia question for you about Africa. This is the first AFIer set there since which previous AFI movie?
Casablanca.
Right. It's also starred Humphrey Bogart.
That's right. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and they're not a lot
of... They never went on location for that one, though.
That's true. We will have more African movies as we go along the project, but I was looking ahead, and we don't do one for quite a while now. We have movies set in other places. We have a lot of movies that will be set in the Middle East, Ben-Hur and Spartacus. They may have shot in other places, but they're set in that part of the world. And Lawrence of Arabia was set in Arabia. And the church is the first Methodist church in Kungdu. Apparently this is the Kenya, Tanzania area of modern Africa. I had to look that up because I wondered where German East Africa even was.
Well, yeah, the river, and I know that they wind up in Kenya at the end.
Don't they say they have to swim to
Kenya? They have to swim to Kenya in the end.
And yet somehow the Germans, who are also in the river alive, aren't going to come after them if they were about ready to hang and kill them.
Good point.
Ah, screw you, we're in the water now. You can go do what you want to do.
They just embrace, you know, and kiss the end.
Laughing as they are, yes. As they do.
I guess they don't embrace, do they?
Well, they can't because they're trying to swim.
No, of course, yeah. Yeah, they just laugh and then the end.
As for our two main characters and the people who are on screen, way, way more than anyone or anything else, well, other than the boat, I guess the third leading player should be the boat itself,
yeah, that
the African
is true,
queen.
Actually.
We like to always joke about how if the name of the movie is said by anybody, that there's a joke, I'll always go, well, that's the name of that movie.
Yes. Well,
if I did that every time we saw the name of the boat on the side of it, then
or even when
I'd
they
be doing
say
it constantly.
It.
Yeah. Another trivia question. How old is the African queen?
Do you mean the boat that they actually used in the shooting?
He says how old it's supposed to be.
Shoot. I can't remember.
30 years.
30 years.
And it dies in the early fall of 1914.
Yeah. Which is when the actual boat was built that they used for the wide shots in 1914.
Yeah.
It was like an actual steamship that was used in African rivers.
I don't think we made that clear. This has got a little steam engine that it's running in. It's one of those faulty things. Of course, that's part of the drama.
Yeah.
That the boiler might not work at one moment or another. And there are two modern references to that. Maybe they're based on this movie. One of them would be the plot in The Shining, the book. The movie doesn't really play this up. The book makes it a big deal about how the boiler is this cheap old thing that Jack has always got to take care of or the whole thing will explode. And spoiler alert for those who've never read The Shining, that's how the hotel gets taken care of at the end. The boiler finally explodes because Jack isn't doing his job. And then Back to the Future Part 3, the train boiler doesn't explode because Marty does make another spoiler. Marty gets back to the future in the DeLorean, but it's if they, you know, what happens when the last log blows? It gets up to this speed or the whole boiler explodes. And there's that great drama.
Well, I mean, that's a cute plot device, right? To, like, just increase suspense.
Mm-hmm.
But the key conflict is the dynamic between Rosie and Charlie.
Yeah, let's get back to that.
Yeah, because Charlie is just so easy and charming, but also complacent and easily defeated. And Rosie is so prissy and difficult, but she's persistent and she's smart and she's a great problem solver. And you initially dislike her. I mean, she's so bossy and she has such high standards, but soon you kind of come to value the positive effect it has on Charlie, who rises to the occasion with Rosie's fire underneath him. Initially, when they fall in love, it seems to happen in this instant. I'm like, did I look away? When they even learn to like each other, I didn't see that part.
Well, it's because they survived the rapids at one point, and then they have this excited sort of...
Because she's an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah, I guess so. And they kiss in a very unsexy kiss.
It's the worst screen kiss. Oh, my God.
Bogart and Jimmy Stewart both went to the same school of kissing. I think they're not very good at
it. Yeah, but even the worst awkward screen, it looks like they should have just done another take. It just feels like, oops, we missed. All right, back to first positions, everybody. That's it. But it just seems like they just did it once and they were like, it's fine. We'll just use that print. It's a terrible, weird kiss.
There's maybe like, that's the point, is that it's because it's 7-0. We're like, I'm going to kiss you because I'm excited about the, oh, I don't want to kiss you.
I know, but they don't pull it off.
No.
They pull other things off in this movie quite nicely. Even like after that, their love is far more convincing and even really sweet.
Well, this is a parable for marriage, for sure. They get married at the end of the story.
Yeah.
But it's something like they're a married couple the whole time and that they do have some fights about the booze, for one thing.
And their relationship eventually does have this really convincing charm, buoyed by the fact that despite their differences and a collection of unlikable characteristics on both part, they're both really good people and they're both really good to each other. And, you know, it's hard not to root for a couple like that. Even if they're unlikely. Even if you don't believe their love affair in the first place.
Even if they do have sex before marriage.
You don't know that.
It's
the
very
camera dissolved.
It
just
always
because
does back
they
then.
Look happy and satisfied. And she asks to finally learn his first name in the morning. Doesn't mean
Charlie.
Anything.
Such a nice name.
Dear.
Yeah, he goes from being Mr. Allnut to being dear. I don't think that after he became a star that Bogart was ever somebody's lackey like this.
Yeah, he's a real pushover. And it's funny because he has a line where he says that the reason he came to Africa is because it was the only place in the world where he didn't have a boss to answer to. But the moment she starts pushing him around, he just doesn't put up a fight at all. But it also seems to kind of be his nature. And he succumbs to it. And he's happy. He's happy when
she's
pushing him around.
He's known her and her brother. I mentioned Mailman and my nutshell. Mm-hmm. And that's because he's not really a mailman. That's one of the many things he brings to them. He brings some supplies too, but mail is one of the things he brings. So it's implied that he's known these people for a little while. So maybe he loved her from afar, but the movie doesn't really make that.
Yeah, it's really not evident if that's the case. Maybe that's in the book. It's based on a book. Maybe there's more to it there, but it really doesn't come through in the movie.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting thing too, because he's supposed to be Canadian and she's supposed to be British, and yet she sounds like she always does.
Yeah.
The Katharine Hepburn Bryn Mawr accent. Bogart was actually supposed to have tried a Cockney accent, but he couldn't pull it off. Yeah. So they just said, you know, we'll just make you Canadian.
Screw it.
And that reminds me of the Costner thing. Kevin Costner couldn't pull off an English accent in Robin Hood. So in the early scenes of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, he's got a, you know, an okay British accent. But I guess they didn't like it well enough, so they just stopped doing it. So he never uses it in most of the movie. And it's funny because Bogart won the Oscar for this performance. And it's such an unusual performance for him. It was probably a matter of three things. One, the people probably did like the performance and probably liked the movie. The people that voted probably thought that. Two, they probably thought he was overdue, which was certainly true. And three, they probably liked that he played against type.
Yeah, yeah, that would be my main argument.
Now, when he did Casablanca, that was playing against type for him because he wasn't a tough guy. He had tough guy moments, but he was playing a romantic lead through most of that movie. Yes, he kills Strasser at the end, but that is a movie that's all about the romance.
At least he was wearing the pants the whole time, which he definitely doesn't in African Queen.
Treasure Sierra Madre was kind of playing back to his bad guy roots, actually, but as a leading character. That was a performance that was overlooked by the Academy. He wasn't even nominated for that one.
Yeah, and that's probably the one that you would definitely call his best performance of his career. But I guess one of those two,
or even Maltese Falcon.
Yeah, but I guess they decided African Queen was the one that was best of that year.
Well, I've said this to some people I know who like the Oscars an awful lot, and we've talked about the Oscars plenty, but hey, we have to. We said before they go hand in hand with the AFI. But here's the spillover effect that happens. So Bogart wins this year, which means that Clift for A Place in the Sun doesn't win, and Brando for Streetcar Named Desire doesn't win. And then Brando wins in 54 for On the Waterfront. Great performance, very deserving. But in a way, Bogart playing Captain Queeg, I think is his name, in the Kane Mutiny, maybe he should have won. And it's that whole thing where somebody wins that year and that knocks out somebody from another year and so on and so on. Of those three performances at least, and there are also two other nominations I can't think of at the moment, Brando's the best one. Clift's probably second best.
Well, listen, it's not a 100-meter dash, you know. There's no science to it. There's so much about it. It's the court of public opinion and the power of the studios that are getting behind these movies and what have you, the campaigns.
And the Academy loves a drunk. We talked about this in the best years of our lives. Then Frederick March won for that performance, which is a third of that movie. And he wins because he essentially plays a drunk. And then Academy has nominated or awarded many times people who play drunks. Although Charlie Allnut's a guy who recovers pretty easily from his drunkardness.
I know, it's kind of hard to believe that he has a problem with alcohol
Doesn't even go through the DTs or doesn't seem to miss it at all.
He's drunk with love for Miss Sayer.
These definitely are an opposite to track type couple, for sure. We saw this last week with our Not 100 Project movie, Eternal Sunshine. Very opposite, yet they continue to keep attracting each other. We're going to see it pretty soon with Rear Window as well. Mm-hmm. And we've seen it with some other movies, of course.
Bringing Up Baby.
Well, it's quite a while ago. I mean, like in our recent history and our soon-to-come future, we're seeing these movies with people that are a great clash, and they're just not going to work out. These two apparently will work out. On a technical note, there's one thing that I thought was impressive for 1951 for people that weren't exactly great beauties to begin with and needed a little bit of help when it came to lighting and camera work, that they let themselves look so bad.
Oh, yeah, do they ever.
Walking Dead-esque sort of hair and and stubble and
by the end of the movie especially, it's,
they're like drowned rats. Even when they're not wet with water, they look like drowned rats.
Apparently, this was an independent film. No studio would pick it up. But apparently one of the problems with selling it was that nobody believed that anybody would want to see a story about two middle-aged people falling in love.
Even though it was Bogart. And, well, then again, Hepburn was going through that box office poison thing again. I was reading about that before Bringing Up Baby. And, well, Bringing Up Baby was part of it, actually. Philadelphia Story is what recovered her.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he was still kind of riding high from his 40s success. And he was still thought of as a big star, but she wasn't quite on that same level. Maybe that was part of it. And Houston insisting on shooting on location wouldn't have helped because people would have said, no, that's a bad idea. That's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
They did almost everything in the studio. Even in the early 50s, that was still a big thing. You know who was doing it so much more at that point were the people in other countries, the Italians and the French.
That's the
new wave that was starting around that time. Maybe the new wave came a little later. But De Sica making Bicycle Thieves and what was that movie, Rome Open City, I think it was called. And some of those kinds of movies were being shot just out in the middle of the streets and just make your movie wherever you can. And maybe Houston was inspired by them.
That's the great influence they got from those directors, although in every other way, this is such a Hollywood film.
So this is Bogart's fourth of four AFI films. He was in Maltese Falcon, Casablanca, Treasure of Sierra Madre. He's all done now.
Mm-hmm.
He's had a hell of a good run. Those are four great films. And he goes through a lot of hell in this movie, but he's softer and nicer than in his previous AFIers. I mean, we already talked about how this isn't his best performance, but it's definitely a kind of like an old man way to go out in a strange way. I mean, no one knew this would be the film that would be last on our list to talk about, of course, but it's almost like that's like his swan song, if you will.
Part of the reason this is his last film on the AFI list is because it was one of the last films he ever made. He was about to die. He didn't live much longer after this.
Yeah, the mid-50s. Mm-hmm. And Hepburn and Spencer Tracy were two of the people that actually seemed to be loyal to him to the end. I think he had friends, but I read somewhere about how when he was dying of, I think it was lung cancer, the only people that really ever visited him were those two. And as for Hepburn, this is her third of four AFI films, after a gap of 16 movies between Philadelphia Story and this one, and she's going to have a gap of 30 movies until we get to Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which is her final film, and the only time we're going to see Spencer Tracy. Yeah. And that was his swan song, because it was his last film. He died very soon after they made it. Another guy who put himself in the grave with the way he lived, unfortunately. So as we said, I think we agreed, it's not her finest work, but I read that she modeled her performance on Eleanor Roosevelt, and that was John Huston's advice. He said that to her in her tent when they were on location, and when he left, she thought about it for a minute and said, that's the best direction I've ever had.
Well, how about that?
So that's, maybe that's why she's got that, what did he say, and put on your society smile, even though she's not liking him at first, and she's not liking the fact she has to go do this. But she's also, as you said at the top, motivated by revenge.
Yeah.
I don't know if we said that the Germans, in World War One, just about to start here, they killed her brother. Well, he dies of the fever, it's kind of because of them, and she's mad about that. Well, they do torch the village, that much is true.
Yeah.
And the natives, incidentally, are just props.
In general, it's like a nice kind of arc that her character goes through, although I don't know if you would call it an arc. It's more like she reveals her character as the film goes on. Initially, you think of her as this kind of prissy spinster, this missionary, and you have all the assumptions that you would make about a character like that. Then she reveals herself to have real grit and brains. She's definitely the drive behind the operation to go and perform this mission, and it's just not something you would ever expect from a character like that.
But then it is played by Katharine Hepburn. And it could have been played by Bette Davis.
I think she could have probably pulled it off, too.
She was in the running for it. Also, the ultimate role could have been played by David Niven or James Mason. They would have been good choices, too, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they would have pulled off the physical comedy. Bogart does an impression of a hippopotamus at one point and then of monkeys.
Yeah, I have to say, though, that's the point where I thought she must be in love because
she's laughing at something that's just not very funny. So on to the director, John Huston. This is his final AFIer as a director, and he will be in Chinatown as an actor. He was one of the writers on this film, and he was nominated in that category because the script was nominated. He co-wrote with James Agee, and then Peter, I think it's pronounced Viertel, and John Collier were uncredited. Viertel later wrote White Hunter Black Heart, and they all based it on C.S. Forster's 1935 novel that you mentioned a minute ago. Forster is also known for the Horatio Hornblower series.
Oh.
I did not know that was him.
I did not know that either.
And the producer was Sam Spiegel, the notoriously cheap Sam Spiegel. There's stories about him when we get to On the Waterfront about his frugalness. And he did produce that film as well as Bridge in the River Kwai and Lawrence of Arabia. So three outdoor epics that he was involved in, along with On the Waterfront. The composer was Alan Gray, another guy who worked with, as did Cardiff, with Powell and Pressburger an awful lot as a music writer. And this is his only AFI film.
Did you like the score?
No, not really.
Yeah, I don't like the score.
Most music of that era wasn't that great, even though so many music scores from that era are in the top 25, or at least nominated for that list that they did, the top 25 music scores list. A lot of old music is bombastic, over the top, and it's just too much of it.
Mm-hmm, I agree.
Even though last week's Not 100 Eternal Sunshine used their music very well. And we talked about that during that podcast, which you should listen to if you haven't already. Now, the influence. There was a TV movie with Sam Peckinpah regular Warren Oates. I mentioned White Hunter Black Heart, and Clint Eastwood directed and starred as John Wilson. Not John Huston.
Huh.
A better impersonation of him, of course, was in There Will Be Blood, Daniel Day-Lewis, which a lot of people have said absolutely owes a debt to John Huston.
Mm-hmm. Was he impersonating John Huston as he actually was? Or John Huston, a character that John Huston played?
The voice, more than anything else.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. I didn't really pick up on that when I saw the movie the first few times, but now when I see it after reading people say that, then I hear it. Another influence would definitely be the leeches scene, which we have not talked about, and that would be Stand By Me, leeches!
I know! I mean, who isn't grossed out by leeches, but there's definitely,
I don't know if the leeches in Stand By Me were real on those kids. They looked like they might have been, but Bogart didn't want any of them to be on him, so he insisted on rubber ones. I think the leech that we see get pulled off of a torso is a close-up of the actual leech handler. That scene was shot in Turkey because they didn't want to go in the water in Africa. It was just apparently too dangerous. You mentioned the crocodiles, and we didn't see any snakes, but there are an awful lot of mambas, I guess, black mambas out there, and probably other kinds of snakes in that African wilderness. So when they did water scenes, I don't think they were ever in Africa. They were either in Turkey or they were in tanks in London.
Yeah.
And here's a weird influence, but Angelica Huston, John's daughter, she tells a story on NPR. Just this past year, she told this story about how John found out that she was born while he was shooting this movie.
Oh, wow.
She was born in 1951.
No dad could ever get away with that now, no matter how great the movie turned out to be.
Oh, he was a character, though. I don't know if he was disloyal to his wives. I'm not going to say that, but he wore the pants and then some, from what I've read about him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was not... Let me put it this way. He would basically tell his wife what was going to happen. I think it was Treasure Sierra Madre came home with some kid. We're adopting this kid. That's the way it is.
And it's so funny that he would have been behind the creation of a film like this where Bogart is the absolute opposite of that.
Yeah, a complete pushover. Mm-hmm. As for the awards and other AFI list, won the Oscar for Bogart, and he got nominated for Best Director, Best Actress for Hepburn, of course, and the screenplay. The National Film Registry added it to its list in 1994. They've been preserving it for 20 years now. And the other AFI lists, 48th in the top 100 Cheers, 14th in the top 100 Passions. And here's the only time we could say this. In their top 50 actors and actresses, mm-hmm. number one, Bogart and Hepburn. And yeah. The only time they're in a movie together, and they are the AFI's choice for the best actor
that
and best actress.
That is pretty cool.
Okay, parting thoughts. We obviously agree this movie should never have been 17th. 65th is maybe even too high.
Yeah, I'm surprised it's on the list at all. Like I said, there's definitely aspects that I enjoyed about it. I wouldn't not recommend it to somebody. I wouldn't if somebody was interested. There's great stuff in it, but as a greatest film of all time, there's way better movies.
How do you feel about it being on the Cheers and Passions list? Cheers because the inspirational part of what they're doing. They do this crazy mission and they do succeed in the end. They get lucky. They create this. I don't think we said this already. They create torpedoes and they stick them out of the hull of the boat. And then when they try to go at the German boat, they get sunk by the holes they create in their own boat.
I can't, they MacGyver these torpedoes and they go through so much to get to where they're going. And there's so much moxie and grit and improvising. And then when they get there, they just cut these giant holes in their boat. Any idiot looks at that and says, well, I don't know if that's gonna float. It doesn't float. Guess what? It sinks. Surprise. Cutting holes in your boat.
And then the dumb luck that the German, I think maybe the iceberg spotters from the Titanic must have survived. And they were the ones that were in the German boat not seeing this wreck
I
do love the shot that establishes that their boat is still out there. Mm-hmm. Almost a Jaws type shot, a waterline shot that shows the one torpedo sticking out of the water just a little bit.
This is what I was talking about where I say the amount that you have to suspend your disbelief by the end of this film is just eye rolling and ridiculous, and it asks too much.
Yeah, but do you agree that it belongs in the Passions and the Cheers lists?
Okay, the Cheers list is a populist list. If people are inspired and fired up by this movie, then I guess I can't dispute that. I can't dispute that people enjoy this movie in that way. Passions, their relationship by the end of the film is absolutely one of the best things about it. So again, it's pretty high. It's pretty high on the Passions list for me. I think I would dispute those less than I dispute the idea that it belongs on a list of greatest films ever.
I think all four of the films from 1951 are on the Passions list. Place in the Sun, Streetcar Named Desire, American in Paris, and this. I think they're all really highly ranked, too. Hmm. We just finished doing four movies from 1951. It's one of the biggest years in the entire list. It's not the biggest, but it's up there with...
Yeah, right, two of them are pretty chaste for passionate movies.
Mm-hmm. Now 1951.
Yeah. Well, the other two are not as chaste.
Yeah. All right. Well, we agree the movie is not quite worthy. Unfortunately, we've had a few of those lately. American in Paris, Place in the Sun, whatever good things they have, there's some major flaws too.
Yeah.
But we do have some interesting films coming up very soon. We're going to be doing a couple westerns that I'm looking forward to you seeing. We mentioned On the Waterfront soon. We mentioned Rear Window soon. So we do have a pretty strong slate. But next week, we've got our second and final look at Gene Kelly and his delightful Singing in the Rain.
Yeah. I can't wait. I'm really jazzed about that
one. So the coming attractions trivia question for Singing in the Rain. As I said, kind of similar to the one for The African Queen. Gene Kelly is one of nine men to direct an AFI film with himself in a starring role. Cameos not included. Scorsese's on cameos. Not included in this question. Who are the other eight? And there's a bonus to this. Name the only actor-director other than Kelly to share director's credit with someone else. Very extensive question. It's going to require some digging.
For the answer to that question, please tune in next week for our podcast about Singing in the Rain. In the meantime, if you'd like more trivia and more other great stuff from Ryan and me, you can find it on our website, top100project.com. Please don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. You can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. And what did you think of African Queen? Are we crazy? Are we wrong? Are we right? We want to know your opinion. Please let us know what you think. Email us at top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
Nature, Mr. Allnut, is what we're put in this world to rise above.
And cut.